the talk is called Karma, Not Self, and Interdependence. Not a light topic or set of topics to actually try to do karma and not self in the same evening. Might be a really bad idea. I'm going to focus more on karma, and we'll see how far we get with no self. And you know, for some people, hearing no self can cause a reaction. And it's just to be very clear: when we lose thinking we're a self, all we lose is the illusion of separateness. We still will be here, and we'll still be unique, and we'll still be distinct. But what we will realize is how interrelated we are. We're not a separate, independent, unchanging self. We are actually a unique filter of basically everything else. So that's the simplest way to think about it. The topic tonight is all under the umbrella of wise view, and wise view is the first step of the Eightfold Path, or first pillar or aspect. It's not necessarily a step because they're not completely linear, the eight pillars of the Eightfold Path. They all interrelate. But let's just do a very quick review. What are the eight folds of the Eightfold Path? And does anyone remember the acronym? Okay, what's the acronym?
Wasn't it Visa, Le, MC?
Yes, okay, good, great. That's the start. What does that stand for? Visa, Le, MC. You're in France, you need to pay for something, but you can't decide should you use your Visa or Le, MC, the MasterCard. Very silly, but we need all the help we can get, right? So this is the order of the Eightfold Path. What does the V stand for?
View.
So, right. So wise view is the first. Yes, intention. View, intention.
Speech.
Wise speech.
Action.
Wise action. Wise livelihood.
Effort.
Wise effort. Should definitely know the M word.
Mindfulness.
Mindfulness. Wise mindfulness.
Concentration.
And wise concentration. Exactly. And the order of the path. Okay, now we'll really tax your memory. Who can break those eight into the three basic divisions of the path? I'll give you a hint. The first two are in one, 3 through 5 are in another, and 6 through 8 are in another. Do you remember the three features of the path? Remember, this is the Eightfold Path. This is basically how to awaken, how to get enlightened. But, you know, less idealistically, just how to be more free in your heart.
I don't remember the specific order, but the first group that comes to my mind is ethics.
Okay, so there's an ethics group.
Uh-huh.
There's a wisdom group. Yeah, the action goes in the ethics. Uh-huh.
Meditation.
Yeah. So sila is the Pali for ethics. Panya is the Pali for wisdom, and they call it samadhi, effort, mindfulness, concentration. Samadhi is a term that's hard to translate into English, but so sila, panya, samadhi. But the order of the path is panya, wisdom, sila, ethics, and samadhi, meditation. The actual order, really functional order, is actually ethics, meditation, wisdom. We have to have an ethical foundation, actually, for our minds to be more quiet. Because if we have a lot of remorse over the harm we cause, it's hard to sit with your mind. So ethics come first, meditation, and then we gain wisdom and through the insight of our practice. But we need a little pre-wisdom to point our little spiritual feet in the right direction. So we, even though functionally wisdom comes last, we need a little pre-wisdom to really point ourselves in the right direction. So wisdom is first. And view is really the pillar, say, upon which the whole path rests. And so I'll read a quote from Bhikkhu Bodhi that you just mentioned. And Bhikkhu Bodhi is very long-term monk. He's a Westerner. He's been in robes a very long time. He's translated most of the authoritative editions of the Pali Canon into English. So really deep scholar. He's also at the forefront of women, getting women ordained, fully ordained in the Theravada tradition. He's even at the forefront of monastic activism. So he's a very interesting guy. But above all, he's a scholar. So he writes, he says right view, I prefer the term wise view. Right view is the forerunner of the entire path, the guide for all the other factors. It enables us to understand our starting point, our destination, and the successive landmarks to pass as practice advances. To attempt to engage in the practice without a foundation of wise view is to risk getting lost in the futility of undirected movement. Doing so might be compared to wanting to drive someplace without consulting a road map. You might get into the car and start to drive, but rather than approaching closer to one's destination, one's more likely to move farther away. The importance of right view can be gauged from the fact that our perspectives on the crucial issues of reality and value have a bearing that goes beyond mere theoretical convictions. They govern our attitudes, our actions, our whole orientation to existence. They structure our perceptions, order our values, crystallize into the ideational framework through which we interpret to ourselves the meaning of our being in the world. These views then condition action. They lie behind our choices and goals and our efforts to turn these goals from ideals into actuality. Our preconceptions about things radically shape our behavior, our emotions, our actions, everything. And just one example of how much our thoughts and our interpretations affect our emotions. So in Thailand, it might be true of other Southeast Asia countries, but it's considered very disrespectful to touch someone's head. So if you're sitting there, you know, in conversation with somebody and there's a fly on someone's head or a mosquito and you want to just, you know, dust it off, for you that would be an act of real care and respect, you know. If you actually did that, the person might be very offended. And you're both coming from wildly different views. Both of you are concerned about respect. I think I'm doing a respectful thing by brushing off the fly. The other person thinks I've really disrespected them by touching their head. So, and there could be very strong emotions. And those views are often very implicit, not at all explicit. We don't know. We have views. But our emotions get, you know, crystallized into something strong, often depending on our views. So the scholarly, the Gelugpa tradition, the scholarly tradition of Tibetan Buddhism, which the Dalai Lama is a product of, they like to say everybody's a philosopher. By that, they mean that, you know, everybody is operating on views and ideas about how things are. So whether we're explicitly knowing it or implicitly not knowing it, we're operating out of our views. So it's not a question of whether or not we have views. It's a question of whether or not to become conscious of them. And we will always have views. The trick is not to be attached. It's to know we're having views and to know actually how extremely limited our views are. And many of you have heard me say this, but for anyone who is new, a thought can never be true. The best a thought can be is useful. Thoughts can be useful or not useful or just neutral, but they can never be true because thoughts are just symbolizing reality. They are always the map and not the territory. And thoughts have so many flaws as a result, just like any map has a flaw. You know, when you think of a map of the U.S., what's the picture in your mind? What's on the map? When you picture a map of the U.S.?
States.
States, okay. So that's a political map.
It's a bunch of polygons that don't really exist.
Okay. A bunch of polygons that don't exist. What else is on the map?
Mountains.
Mountains?
Huh?
Colors.
Roads.
So why not geologic formations? Or why not coffee shops? Or why not blues venues? Right? Why would it be highways or states? Because we're coming from a particular point of view or a particular concern. So we make a map of something based on something we're concerned about. And just like a map of the U.S. can't be the U.S., our ideas about anything can't be the thing because we're coming from a very limited perspective. We have a particular concern, and our ideas get guided by that concern. So, while our thoughts can never be true, we want to make very sure, because they do affect us so much, that we're going to choose more from the useful bin and less from the not useful bin. So in the Buddhist terminology, we use skillful and unskillful. So skillful thoughts are thoughts that actually help you be happier, help you connect better, help you sort of be of more benefit to others. And the thoughts that aren't so useful, I mean, we all know, right? It's that make us feel disconnected or make us feel bad about ourselves or make us feel bad about others or somehow immobilize us or isolate us, you know? We can all agree, right? Those are not very helpful thoughts. So really important to look at our views. The Buddha said, there's no single factor so responsible for the suffering of living beings as wrong view, and no factor so potent in promoting the good of living beings as right view. So again, wise view. It's really about having our thoughts be as useful as they can be. And so this is the forerunner of the entire path, the entire spiritual path. And so there's a lot we could want to deconstruct about our views. But the Buddha boiled it down to two basic things. Wise view really is very important in wise view to understand kamma. That's the Pali. The Sanskrit is karma. That's what we all know. I'll use kamma because that's our tradition. Very, very important to understand kamma. And we're going to focus on that. But that's called mundane wise view or right view. And the superior wise view, that it's very important to understand karma, but that doesn't necessarily lead us to want to be liberated from the wheel of samsara, from suffering. So the view that's really supreme and that will really like guide us, you know, with more intensity towards awakening is the view of understanding the Four Noble Truths. And we talked about that last week, so I'm not going to really go into that. But because it's so critical and pivotal, let's just say out loud the Four Noble Truths. Life is suffering. Is that the first noble truth? No. It's a very poor misunderstanding of the first noble truth. It's not what the Buddha meant. So we talked about this last week. What did the Buddha really mean with the first noble truth?
Dissatisfaction is inherent to life.
Yes, much more along those lines. Not life is suffering, but life has a kind of pervasive unsatisfactoriness. And why is that? And this is the second noble truth. Why are we caught in being unsatisfied much of the time? We can be very happy, we can, you know, have difficult states, more neutral states, but there can be a kind of like dissatisfaction that we can feel. Why is that? Remember? Yes, it has to do with craving, attachment, exactly. Craving is the cause of our dissatisfaction. So what do we mean by craving? It's not the same thing as desire, though it's related.
Wanting what is not and not wanting what is?
Yeah, that's more wanting what is not and not wanting what is. That's one way of saying it. It's craving is the umbrella term for our reactions of greed to pleasant, aversion to unpleasant, and delusion or ignorance of the neutral. We don't notice the neutral. We only want the pleasant, and we definitely don't want the unpleasant. The reason that's unsatisfying is because pleasant, which we base our happiness on, doesn't happen all the time. If it did, no problem. But we are unsatisfied because we keep looking for our happiness from pleasure. And actually our heart wants like real, permanent, perpetual, deep satisfaction. And so if we're not getting that, we're not satisfied. It isn't enough. So the Buddhist path, then the third truth is all about what? Yes. The end of basing our happiness on pleasure. There is a happiness that doesn't depend on pleasantness. So, and it's called nibbana, but that can sound very pie in the sky. Nirvana is Sanskrit, nibbana is Pali. It just means that we can be sitting here with knee pain, and if we're super mindful of it, the mind isn't perturbed. That's a little mini nibbana. Same thing with a difficult state. We can be scared and actually not stressed about being scared. We can just be scared. We can have something go wrong in our lives, and if we wake up to it mindfully, we can just be sitting there with stress, but not stressing about stress. So these are the practical glimmers we get of nibbana in our daily life. But nibbana is actually saying there's, you can just take that all the way to the bank and be completely free of craving, completely free of greed, aversion, and delusion. Pleasant, unpleasant, neutral will always happen, but the mind stays content and satisfied because happiness is based basically on mindfulness instead of needing to have the pleasant. And the fourth noble truth is?
The cause of the end.
Yes, the cause of the end, or the path to the end. which is the Eightfold Path. Great. So those truths are absolutely rock bottom. They're basic. They're the most basic Theravada teaching. And they're absolutely fundamental. It's the most basic in the most profound sense. If we really understood the Four Noble Truths, we would be awake fully. So that's the superior or supreme wise view, is really understanding the Four Noble Truths. And it's a lifetime of study. It's very simple to say. You know, it's not intellectually very sexy. The Buddha made it so simple. It's like he's not going to give us intellectual candy to distract ourselves with. This is, you know, the bomb. This is the absolute pith of it. If you could really apply the Four Noble Truths day in, day out in your life, you'd be a lot happier. So we focused on that last week. So this week we're going to focus more on karma. And then the third thing I want to throw in, which I feel is really critical, it's not so canonical included as part of Wise View, but it's just all through the Pali Canon. It's really important to understand, is that we have this illusion, we can call it essentialism. We believe in things having an essence. A banana has an essence, a basketball has an essence, a car has an essence, and so do you. We believe this. So, and the Buddha said, you can't find an essence. You can't find an essence in a ball, a car, or in you. And we carry around this mistaken view all day long. It's one of these implicit views that we have that we don't know we have. And it is the linchpin of our suffering, because if we feel we have an essence, there is a little mini me inside of here that is the real me, that hasn't changed, that is its own, you know, separate little essence. Then I have to protect that, and it makes me very separate from everything else. So it's the linchpin of our suffering, this idea of separateness. So we'll get to that at the end of class, and we'll probably revisit it more fully in the next class, because it's so important to get this. So karma. Anyone want to define karma or karma? There's a two-word definition.
Cause and effect.
Bad habits. There could be good habits too.
Maybe in terms of predisposition sometimes.
Uh-huh. Sort of like habits, but yeah, predisposition's a little different. It actually is the motivation that our actions stem from. So it's volitional action is like the two-word definition of karma. But what it really means is it's the motivation that our actions come from. Our actions themselves are not necessarily karmically bound. It's the mind state that the actions are springing from that actually leaves karmic imprints. An example being, a thief can, you know, jab someone with a knife, or a surgeon can jab someone with a knife and have two very different results. The mind state in the surgeon is to benefit. The mind state of the thief is to harm. So it's not the actions per se that cause our karma or karma. It's the mind states they spring from. So, karma is a very mysterious, complex thing to talk about, think about. And the Buddha said, if you think about it too much, your head will explode. So we'll do about 20 minutes and hopefully everyone gets out alive. If the path, the spiritual path, is one of going from a state of dukkha, unsatisfactoriness, to a state of nibbana, which is the deepest happiness, which is peace, real peacefulness with how life is, we're actually not rocked by all the to's and fro's of existence. We have a real peace, not from chaos, but a peace within chaos, within the chaos of our lives. We're fully at peace in our lives exactly as our lives are. And yes, that completely includes, you know, making changes as part of our peace. But our motivation comes from compassion rather than anger. So it comes from seeing what's needed and responding. So a path is one of changing ourselves. And to change, we have to know how to change. And to know how to change, we have to know how we got to be the way we are. And so the Buddhist answer to this is karma. That what determines our happiness, how we are right now, is not a little mini-me, a little self that is here willing how you're doing, right? If we could just will happiness, no one would ever come to a meditation class or, you know, do any spiritual path. There would be no need, because we could actually just be happy. But we can't, right? We can't just will our happiness. So what determines our happiness? It's karma. This is the Buddhist view. It's the sum total of all your volitional actions. And that somehow are determining how you're doing right now. And unfortunately for us, the Buddha made it complicated because he said it's not just from this life, that our volitional actions have karmic momentum, which is basically like saying they somehow perpetuate in our mind stream from life to life. So we can never have any clue how our past actions are coming to bear. But we know that how we're doing is a result of our past mental volitional actions. In short, it's our choices and our actions in the past and the mind states those actions came from that actually are determining how we're doing right now. So, this is the map. This is that if we're going to drive, you know, in Bhikkhu Bodhi's analogy, this is the map of how we change. We are the way we are because of karma. We're going to change how we are because in a karmic process. And it's actually, even though it's so woo-woo in certain ways, you know, past lives and how that affects us, the Buddha made it very simple. The way we karmically determine our well-being is we act from skillful motivations, and that leads to happiness. And we avoid acting from unskillful motivations because that leads to suffering. So it really all boils down to if the mind state in our action is from greed, aversion, or delusion, these are the three roots of our suffering, then we are somehow karmically planting seeds that will ripen in the future as some kind of unhappiness. If we are acting from mind states that are the opposite, so the opposite of greed being either generosity or renunciation, The opposite of aversion being kindness or goodwill. And the opposite of delusion being wisdom. The easiest way to access that is through mindfulness. So it actually is very, very simple. If you really want to take karma to heart and become happier, you want to act when you have a generous impulse. You want to act when you have a kind impulse. You want to act when you have an impulse to be mindful. It's very simple. And when you see a real kind of greed motivation, you want to actually, instead of acting it out, just turn towards the greed and be mindful of the greed. And if there's aversion, the same thing. Turn towards it and be mindful instead of acting on it. And the same thing with delusion. It's very hard to know when you're deluded by definition. So all of the mysteriousness of karma gets boiled down to this simple. Doesn't it sound nice? Be generous, be kind, be mindful. And I mean, there's gazillion treatises written on karma, but it boils down to this simplicity. To me, it's so sweet and simple. Be generous, be kind, be mindful. Doesn't that sound nice? But there's a huge body of theory, you know, saying that's the best way to become happy. So, I'll just stop here for now, see if there's any input, questions or comments, responses.
One question comes up about the second retreat specifically. Since we're talking about it, something a question I've had for a while. In some descriptions, I think probably when you think about it, it's typically in some in context of the Tibetan teaching, when talking about fundamental cause of suffering is often expressed as ignorance, but being more fundamental than craving, aversion, delusion, in the sense that being ignorant of the factors that cause the karma, such as, you know, amplifying the attractive aspects of something or amplifying the repulsive aspects of something. So like an ignorance of that process that is in some sense more fundamental than craving, aversion, delusion. So would you say that is a Tibetan articulation specifically, or a difference from Theravada?
Well, I mean, if you look at, say, with Theravada, within the dependent origination 12 steps, ignorance is first. And then the whole, all of it, you know, gets born through ignorance. I don't feel like in a practical way it's very important to be too hierarchical about it, like ignorance is more important than craving. But in the wheel of dependent origination, the two ways that you cut the cycle is with mindfulness, either at the first link, which is ignorance, or at the link between feeling tone, which is vedana, and craving. In both places, it's mindfulness that comes in and breaks the cycle. So either way, the remedy is mindfulness. And if you want to, you know, like get into some ontological thing, like ignorance is first, craving, you know, I mean, you could definitely say that we crave because we're ignorant. So, you know, you can say that, I think, fairly safely. But so, you know, but actually it's more operational to say craving. Because if you think of greed, aversion, and delusion, the prescription for how to be happy is not to just don't be ignorant. Like, that's sort of like, okay, well, what do I do? Well, what you actually do is you wake up and be mindful. And when you're mindful, then you choose to act from generosity, kindness, and wisdom, as opposed to greed, aversion, delusion. So operationally, to me, it's a lot more specific to just think greed, aversion, delusion. That's really what I'm going to be on the lookout for. Yes.
One place where I have kind of a question is the notion of being volitional.
Okay.
In some ways, what you're describing seems very unconscious. That momentum.
Yes.
Karma.
Right.
And that it is the waking up to it, and that moment of being aware of your reactivity and making a different choice. So I'm not totally clear to what extent it's truly volitional. Does that make sense?
Yes. So the question is around, it seems like a lot of our actions, and these aren't your words, but let me just repeat, especially maybe our unskillful ones, are actually coming unconsciously, so they're not volitional. And actually, you're right. And it's our non-volitional actions that are even more tainted, because we might be doing them with a lot more force. If we don't know what we're doing, we're just going to really go for it. If we're more like... There's a line from a movie, analyze this, where that's going to be a major distraction. But but Robert De Niro, who's the mafia boss, Billy Crystal's the shrink, and they get into a scene where, you know, Robert De Niro wants to shoot Billy Crystal and tries to, but the gun is not loaded, and so they have this big like unpacking of it, and Robert De Niro says, "Well, I'm making progress because I mean I wanted to shoot you, but." But I was conflicted about it, you know. So actually, when we are conscious, there's not going to be as much, as some people say, as much volitional or karmic force, because we are going to like be a little bit like, ooh, is this the right thing to do? But in either case, the answer is mindfulness. We really need to wake up to our behavior, whether it's especially the unconscious behavior. So, and there's probably a little semantical thing, unconscious versus volitional, and volitional includes unconscious, because there's even if we're not conscious, actually there's still a mind state that we're acting out of. A perfect example being an animal, you know, like just, you know, the Buddhist theory is that animals don't have the ability to be reflexive about, oh, I'm a cat and I'm going to go for this bird, you know. Is that the most skillful choice, right? Greed, boom, you know, go for the bird. So there's still volitional action even though it's unconscious. Does that make sense? So volitional includes our conscious impulses and our unconscious ones. We're still acting out of motivations that are greed, aversion, and delusion. So. Yeah.
This is probably getting off the path. I just always wanted to ask, so did they have a teaching about how animals may be at different levels of awareness? Because you see some animals just seem to be just more there just than others. I don't know.
There might be in the Pali canon. I'm not aware of it. I'm not a Pali canon scholar, so I can't say, but generally... animals are considered to be in a suffering realm because they are absolutely at the mercy of greed, aversion, delusion. They don't know. And because of that, they're creating a lot of karmically difficult states for themselves. So I'm not aware of, again, you know, this is just one view of the animal world, but this is a traditional Buddhist view. And I'm not aware of different levels of some animals more aware than others. Okay, we'll take a break. So you can look at karma as very victimizing, or you can look at it as very empowering. The victim part is that it is completely out of your control and also completely mysterious how our past actions bear fruit in the present. So that is completely out of our control. Given that, what we can do in the present moment, we do have control, but the only control we have is how we respond to the moment to which we just awoke. Until we're mindful, we have absolutely no control. Until we're aware. And we wake up to a mind state. We wake up to something. That's when we have control in that little tiny dot of nowness. This is when we can really make a big change. And the Buddhist analogy is that we are planting seeds with all of our volitional actions. Every time we have a mind state, we're basically greasing the skids of the brain for more of the same. It's how the brain works. The more we practice loving kindness, the kinder we become. The more we practice anger, the angrier we become. So we can plant seeds, but that's all we can do. And the seed we plant is every response we have in the present moment to what we're aware of. So that's the seed. That we can control. What we can't control is when past seeds bear fruit or come you know, sprout, and when future seeds will sprout. We can't control that, but we can plant the seed again and again and again and again. You know, and this is like, you know, happening this fast. So this can feel very limited. But it's very powerful. Because every seed you drop is going to sprout. So we are always conditioning our future with how we're doing right now. So we can't control, because karma unfolds out of our control, we better be very responsible for what seeds we want to be planting now, because those will sprout later out of our control. So we really want to pay attention to what we're planting. And so, again, remember, where do you want your seeds to come from? What are the three mind states you want to be planting a lot of?
Kindness.
Generosity. Mindfulness, right? And wisdom is sort of hard to order up, but we can order up mindfulness. And mindfulness leads to wisdom, right? So again, that's why I say you want to act on those impulses, and you want to refrain from acting on the greed, aversion, delusion. Not as a tightness, but we refrain by being mindful and fully allowing the experience of greed, aversion, and delusion, but without acting on it. We can fully allow our difficult states when we're not going to act them out. Because if you act them out, you know, you can't have your anger as strong, because you don't want to hurt somebody as much, right? So actually we can have our mind states much more deeply if we don't act them out. If we actually instead, we're protected by the safety of mindfulness. So you can rip someone a new one, you know, in the protection of your kind attention. So this is very, very important. We wake up to greed, aversion, and delusion usually with, oh, no, not that. That's really bad for my karma. Which is what? What is that seed?
Aversion.
Well, oh, no, not aversion. I can't believe I had aversion. And that's just aversion to your aversion. So this is a very interesting thing. This is extremely kind. You can just say, instead of that unskillful reaction of greed, aversion, or delusion to your greed, aversion, or delusion, how you want to respond, let's just call it GAD, how you want to respond to that is out of kindness or mindfulness or generosity. So you're immediately changing your karma. And this is very, very critical to get, and super important. It's like instant karma. To just be like, oh, anger. What's anger like, right? That's instant karma. You just went from unskillful to skillful. But if you sit there like, I can't believe this, I'm so angry, but I don't want to be angry, like, right? That's just more unskillfulness. So the skillfulness is very kind, non-judgmental, and curious. So this is the best way to be happy. And you will need to do this a gazillion times, is wake up in kindness and non-judgment to your total neurosis. You're messed up, flawed, imperfect, suffering, struggling, stressed out you, right? Often the rubber meets the road. It's immediately, the minute we get conscious and mindful and kind towards it. It's the best way to change your karma, the fastest way. So Anne Frank said, how wonderful it is that nobody need wait a single minute before starting to improve the world. And I can take that to mean as you can start right now by being kind and mindful, you know, to the difficulty or way that you criticize yourself. If you have to wait, to see yourself in a really good light before you're kind to yourself, we all might be waiting a little while. We can wake up right now and be kind and mindful instantly. So, some of you have seen this before. We won't spend a whole lot of time on it. But this is a much more detailed elaboration of wholesome and unwholesome, or skillful and unskillful. So it's taking those three roots of suffering, greed, aversion, delusion, and the three roots of happiness, generosity, kindness, wisdom, and unpacking them into a lot of different mind states. So you can just keep that. We won't really go through it too much. But the last little thing to say about karma is what's so great about this is that it transcends the duality of self and other. That being selfless and selfish are one and the same thing. If what's best for you is to be kind, that's best for others. If what's best for you is to be mindful, that's best for others. If what's best for you is to be generous, that's best for others. Isn't that awesome? In this really like mysterious, very elaborate, very technical, like, you know, descriptions of karma that you can get, it's just this simple. So this is how to be happy. This is the roadmap. We need to start right where we are with kindness and mindfulness. We can change our karma the moment we just relax and accept and be mindful of our experience. So David White has a little something to say about this. He has a poem called Start Close In. This is an excerpt from the poem. Start close in. Don't take the second step or the third. Start with the first thing close in, the step you don't want to take. Start with the ground you know, the pale ground beneath your feet, your own way of starting the conversation. Start with your own question. Give up on other people's questions. Don't let them smother something simple. Start right now. Take a small step you can call your own. Don't follow someone else's heroics. Be humble and focused. Start close in. Don't mistake that other for your own. Start close in. Don't take the second step or the third. Start with the first thing close in, the step you don't want to take. It takes humility to do this. It takes self-forgiveness. It takes honesty. But we have the simple tools. They're not hard. It's not hard to be mindful. It's hard to remember to be mindful. But when you do, it's actually pretty easy, you know? And mindfulness, we can't get too tricky. We are simple and humble and straightforward. So a cartoon about being tricky. The cartoon is a woman standing in the doorway looking at the man who's folding laundry, saying, "Look at you, folding the laundry 2 days before couples therapy." If you've ever done couples therapy, you can relate to that. That's kind of tricky, right? Mindfulness won't, we can't fool ourselves. If we just stop and say, what's my experience? Mindfulness is just going to mirror it exactly how you are. You know? It's not tricky. But this is how we instantly change our karma. And we have to be deeply, deeply self-forgiving. We have to come pre-forgiven. We're all screw-ups. We're all like spinning around in greed, aversion, and delusion a lot. If you watch your mind, I know it about all of us. We're all doing this a lot. So we can be very forgiving. It's like, yeah, of course. But we do have this potential to wake up. So pre-forgive yourself. So this is an Alison Luderman poem on the topic. Because these failures are my job. This morning I failed to notice the pearl gray moment just before sunrise when everything lightens. Failed also to find birdsong under the grinding of garbage trucks, and later the walking through the woods to stop thinking for even 5 consecutive steps. Then there was the failure to name the exact shade of blue overhead, not sapphire, not azure, not Delft. To savor the soft squelch of pine needles underfoot. Later I found the fork raised halfway to my mouth while I was still chewing the last untasted bite. And so it went until finally wading into sleep's thick undertow, I felt myself drift from dream to dream, forever failing to comprehend where I am falling from or to. This blurred life with only moments caught in attention's loose sieve. Tiny pearls fished out of oblivion's sea, laid out here as offering or apology or thank you. I just love that. Failing at mindfulness is your job. You will fail repeatedly. So what? Big deal. Because this is a Tibetan saying, when you walk into a room and flick on the light, it doesn't matter how long the room has been dark. It's light. It's just as light. It does not matter. Fail forward. We just fail. And we don't notice. But we can always notice in any moment. And that's everything. And here's a little forgiveness humor on the topic of self-forgiveness. You'll see it. It's a squirrel like on a little Buddha statue with the little hair knot on top of the Buddha. And the squirrel's saying, oh, forgive me. It's just that your head looks a lot like an acorn. Again, change your karma instantly. Forgive yourself. Know you're going to fail with mindfulness 1,000 times a day. Big deal. So just remember, generous, kind, mindful. It's so simple. That's the best way to build your happiness. Okay. That's the karma segment. Anyone want to respond?
I was kind of struck by a few things you said. I've heard and read some of these things, about karma being mysterious. We can't quite know when these seeds or control when they arise in the future. And I get that. And then there's another thing which is related to the Buddha talking about belief teachings that work in your experience.
Yes.
And so I'm wondering if you comment on another view, which is that karma is really very simple. When you see what choices you and other people, our country, our families, everything have made,
right.
You see what comes out of that.
Yes.
You start applying mindfulness and realize it's vitally important.
Yes.
Everything you do.
Yes.
You don't need a wallet to tell you that. It's kind of like,
yes. Yes. So the comment, if this is right, actually there's many ways in which cause and effect are not very mysterious. It's very straightforward, right? Like we can see things we do and see immediately, you know, like how much suffering is being created. And so, yeah, to just, yeah, take action right there, right when you see it. Did I get it? Is there a question you want me? Yeah. Yes, so then you said, like, in relation to, you know, just, you know, trust your experience, trust what you see. Yeah, exactly, very much. The two come together, like you're saying, in the obvious karma, where it's just like, duh. We really see cause and effect very clearly. Yeah.
The word that comes to me is awareness.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And sometimes that's not as easy as we would like to be.
Yes.
In my experience.
Yes.
And when you talked about just be mindful of what is happening right now, or David White's poem, The First Step, that to me is often a hard one to see.
Yes, exactly.
Because it's so right here.
Exactly.
But it is really key.
Yes, exactly.
But often I think something needs to be done three or four steps.
Exactly.
I don't see it's, and it feels like a training, a learning.
Yes.
To know what is that first.
Yes.
What is closing.
Exactly. So the comment is that it's actually very hard to it's always very hard, or it can be very hard to really notice what's so close in that first step. We go to third or fourth. So, and our practice is, it's why we call it practice. Because, yes, the first step is always what's happening right now in this moment. And we can get so tricky with that, you know, folding the laundry, you know, inside 2 days before couples therapy, so we don't look bad to ourselves, or we just get very tricky. So, you know, trust that mindfulness practice is training again and again and again, and not being tricky, and just saying, right, I'm sad, I'm scared, I'm so happy, you know, oh, I'm really anxious, I'm really stressed, you know, like, I mean, this question, again, is, you know, I mean, what am I feeling right now is a very sacred question, and then what's it like is a very sacred question. It's not how, it's not why. How and why are third and fourth steps. What is the question? That's first step. What is happening right now, or what am I feeling, or what's it like? Exactly. And if it's judging that's there as the second step, as soon as you notice the judging, that's the first step, because that's what is right now. So but it's very hard, you know, it's hard to admit or be with how we're doing. Sometimes we don't want to see it. So that's why I say it can be very humbling. It requires a ton of kindness, a ton of self-forgiveness. But it's so powerful when we do it. Because if we're at the first step, then the next steps make sense. If we're at the fourth step, we don't even know where we are, right? So it means being very vulnerable often. And open.
What about the relationship between mindfulness and awareness? At least one inclination I have is to think that mindfulness alone is not enough
mm-hmm.
to give meaning
mm-hmm.
to your being in the world.
Mm-hmm.
That in order for that to be, it has to be accompanied with some kind of awareness.
And when you use the word awareness, how are you distinguishing it from mindfulness?
It's for me, the mindfulness is more sensory.
Okay. Pre-concept?
Yeah.
Okay.
And the awareness is putting it together somehow.
Okay.
Not necessarily in a conceptual way. Yeah. Like maybe resulting in a wise view or something like that.
Yes, exactly. Really, in a way, what you're saying is how to combine mindfulness with useful thinking, maybe. Around meaning, around, you know, life direction, life plan. Like, mindfulness isn't enough.
Right.
So that we, and I would completely agree with you, we have to be very skillful in our thoughts. I mean, you know, the thought, I'm hungry, you know, it's okay. Wise response is, you know, to eat. So we need our thoughts very much. The reason generally in Dharma circles that we emphasize mindfulness so much is because it's so rare, right? So we talk mindfulness, mindfulness, mindfulness. But it's the balance we need. We're so, so habitually caught in our nets of thinking that we need to really emphasize the mindfulness, because with a lot of mindfulness, then thinking gets put in its proper place as something that can be useful or not, and that's all, right? But we really need a lot of mindfulness to get to that perspective. And you know, you're also kind of talking ultimate and relative, you know? From an ultimate perspective, mindfulness is enough, but as relative beings living in the world, it's not. We have to really, like, think wisely about what we need and where to go and what our direction is, and feel wisely what we want. Yeah. Okay, not self. The quick version is, you don't have one. No, that's actually not the quick version. The quick version is, you can't find it. The Buddha never said you don't have one. That's why the term we use is not self, to distinguish it from no self. Just a little semantical thing. But not self means, if you actually look for it, you can't find it. So you're going to have to stay tuned, because we're not going to be able to get to it. But don't worry about some like philosophical kind of like, oh no, I'm not a self. Because that is also wrong view or unhelpful view. You're just not this independent, separate thing. That's the easiest way to think about it. The other practical way to think about it is, you're not in very much control. The assumptions of self are fourfold. I'm singular. If I'm a self, then I'm an, you know, there's this part of me that I can boil myself down to, that's just one thing. And that one thing hasn't changed. It's been there since I was a baby, and it's here right now, and I'll be there, you know, as I die. And I'm independent. These are all the assumptions of essentialism, something having an essence. Something with an essence is singular, separate, and unchanging. And then the fourth, more psychological assumption is that I'm in control. There's a way in which I'm in control. I am the person that came to meditation class. I am the person who's going to leave. I am the person driving. I am the person making decisions. I. That's this agency factor. So All four of these are going to be debunked, and you'll see how you can't find them, that everything you think is a self is not actually a self. What it is self-ing. It's the activity of creating the illusion of self. Every time you look for self, that's what you're going to find. So I'm going to unpack that in a lot of ways. The simplest way to unpack an essence is to consider an apple. Can someone tell me the essence of an apple? It's a word. We say the apple. What are we referring to, right, that is indisputably apple?
Apple DNA.
DNA has genes, where parts of DNA are genes and parts are not. There's many parts of a DNA strand that don't express. So are the parts that don't express apple? They would have to be. But if they don't express, couldn't they also be bulldozer? Couldn't they be anything if they don't express? Yeah, we have lots of parts of our DNA. A DNA has parts. And because something has parts, the problem with an essence is if it has parts, it's not an essence. Because if something has parts, then you have to ask yourself, are both necessary if there's just two parts? So let's take the parts thing a little bit to apple. What are the parts of an apple? Does an apple have parts or is it one thing? Yeah. What are the parts?
Seeds.
Yeah, skin, seeds, stems.
Water.
Right. So right away it's not an essence. If that doesn't make sense to you, then just ask yourself, which of these parts are necessary? Does an apple have to have seeds to be an apple? Okay, we can breed seedless apples, I assume. Is it an apple if it doesn't have seeds? So that's just what. So cut the stem completely off the apple. Is it an apple still? Yes? No? Let's all say it once. Yes, just say yes or no. Everyone agrees. Does anyone disagree?
I'm not sure.
Okay. Ooh. Let's take the skin off. So we've removed the stem, we've removed the skin. And there's no seeds. There's just flesh. Is it an apple?
Yes.
Yes? What?
I'm still not sure.
Still not sure? Is it an apple if it's just the flesh? A seedless?
Skinless,
skinless, stemless, seedless?
You call it an apple. You probably call
it. Yes, but is what you're calling an apple the essence that the word apple is referring to? Because you could put an apple with skin, with stem, an apple without stem, an apple with seeds, without seeds. You could put all of these things there, and we would all still say apple. That's confusing. What do we actually mean when we say apple? Pardon? Yeah, it's appleness, right? Right, there's appleness there. Does it have to have apple taste to be an apple? So let's picture this apple. Let's put all the parts back. It has all the parts, but then it starts rotting. And now it has rotten apple flavor. Is it still apple? I think you get the idea. And how about when a flower, which is pollinated probably by bees, I assume apples are pollinated by insects, and then, you know, the pollen comes in to the flower, and together they start multiplying cellularly. At what point is it an apple? Is the sperm and the egg joined an apple? You can do that. at what point in the birth of this thing does it become apple? And at what point, as it rots away, does it become not apple? You can see, when we talk about the simple little word apple, it's hugely complex. And it's pointing at nothing that we think it's pointing at. What it's pointing at is all of those things. Do you see how there's no essence to apple? That the word presumes that essence isn't there. What it is a temporary collection of parts. That's what an apple is. That's not an essence. It's a temporary collection. Because at some point the seeds aren't there until the apple matures. And then when it rots away, maybe the flesh rots first and the seeds stay. It's a temporary collection. So the most accurate, wise thought you can have about any object is temporary collection of parts. And let me just tweak your mind a little bit more. If anything has spatial extent, it can't have an essence. Why? Because if picture something that's exactly the same material, a bowling ball, let's say it's exactly uniform all the way through, I can paint the left side of the bowling ball, and that makes it different from the right side. There's a left side that has things happen to it that don't happen over here. So if it has spatial extent, it has parts. So in other words, anything that physically exists cannot have an essence. Yes.
Can you give us an example of an essence?
Something that's separate, singular, and independent, and unchanging. And I can't give you an example. No, there's no such thing. I can't. You can't find it. Yes.
What about the essence of someone after they've passed away?
Is it singular, unchanging, and independent?
I wonder.
Yeah. Well. We're at 8:30. But if that essence of somebody actually has different aspects, or features, or expressions, it's not an essence. Because by definition, when we say essence, we're boiling something down to its essence, right? If it has parts, then we're not at the essence. The essence assumes we're down to one thing. That's what we mean when we say it. Does that make sense?
Well, which is my point. Like, someone who's passed away, there is no part anymore. But there are memories of love someone who's passed away, and remembering. You may not remember the whole thing, or even what it looked like, but the voice sounds like after a while.
Right.
But you're having this memory of who that person was to you.
If that person was an essence, then everyone would have the same memory. But people are going to have different memories of the same person.
That makes more sense.
Yeah.
So what gets reincarnated?
So this is all like spooky and freaky, right? We all think there's a self. And then, so we could maybe accept that maybe a self could get reborn. But if there's not a self, that gets reborn? Are you kidding me? Right? This is where it's completely like weird and mysterious, and your head will split open. Trungpa Rinpoche said what gets reborn is your bad habits. Because the Buddhist theory is once we get fully enlightened, we don't come back. So we only come back because we're still suffering. Isn't that optimistic? It's kind of a buzzkill of a religion. You keep coming back while it sucks. And then once it finally doesn't suck, then you don't come back. Damn.
Unless you're a bodhisattva.
Unless you're a bodhisattva. But you only come back because they're not fully realized. They have to forego full awakening in order to come back.
Right.
Oh, you keep coming back to class because it sucks. That's funny. Yeah, on that happy.